diabolical, and it came so close to succeeding.
It still might.
Amberlee's voice was grim. We're the only two left who know about this. If we can't tell the Lord General, they might still succeed. I finished for her. The prospect of that was almost too grim to be contemplated, and we walked on together in silence for some time. Perhaps it was just as well that we did, for, after a while, I began to detect a faint murmur up ahead over the scuff of our boot soles through the thick dust which carpeted the corridor ahead of us. I had found that reassuring, since it would muffle our footfalls, and indicated quite clearly that no one else had been this way in decades, which meant we were unlikely to be running into any more ambushes. The presence of other sounds down there, though, might be a cause for concern. I held up my hand and doused my luminator, waiting again for my eyes to adjust, the last remnants of my torpor dropping away like a blanket at reveille, replaced by a sudden surge of adrenaline. "What is it?" Amberlee asked, following suit and plunging us into even deeper darkness. "I'm not sure," I admitted, "but I think I can hear something." To my pleased surprise, she didn't ask for more details, evidently trusting me to provide them if I had them, so I concentrated my energies on listening. It wasn't even a sound as such, more a vibration in the air. The nearest I can come to explaining it is by saying that it was akin to the way I could tell roughly how close I was to a wall in the dark by the way the echoes changed. Bottom line is, you either know what I'm talking about, in which case you probably grew up in the Underhive too, or you'll just have to take my word for it. In any event, there was nothing to be gained by staying here, so we moved on at last, trusting my dark-attuned senses rather than activating the luminators again. My palms were tingling in that old familiar way, and Amberlee seemed to trust my instincts, at least in this environment. The corridor continued to be relatively open ahead of us, so moving in the dark was less taxing than you might think, and I gradually became aware of the faint luminescence ahead of us in the gloom. "Is that light ahead?" Amberlee murmured, confirming my thought, and I whispered an agreement. The sounds were getting louder too, but still too faint to discern. There was an organic quality about them, though, which raised the hairs on the back of my neck. "About half a clomb," I added, still keeping my voice low and hefting the pistol in my hand. "Maybe it's a way up to the surface," she whispered hopefully. I shook my head, not sure whether she would be able to see the movement yet against the gradually intensifying glow. "We've come too deep for that. We must have gone down at least 3 levels in the last couple of hours."
"And you didn't say anything?"
Her voice was a furious hiss, and for the first time I realized she hadn't noticed the change in depth.
"We were supposed to be looking for a way out, in case you'd forgotten." "I thought you knew," I snapped back, feeling oddly defensive. "You're the one in charge of this expedition, remember?"
"I am.
Oh, yes, now you come to mention it, I suppose I am."
There was a petulant edge to her voice, which I found incongruously at odds with her rank and power, and all at once I felt an overwhelming urge to laugh. It was probably just the tension, but the full absurdity of the situation suddenly hit me. Here we were, the only two people left alive to warn the Imperium of a terrifying threat, lost, alone, outnumbered, surrounded by an army of monsters, bickering like a couple of juvies on a disappointing date. I bit my lower lip, but the harder I tried to suppress it, the more the laughter effervesced inside my chest, until it finally escaped with an audible snort. That did it. She lost her temper completely.
"You think that's funny?" she snapped,
all thoughts of concealment now completely forgotten. I should have been terrified, of course, the wrath of Inquisitors not being something to be lightly invoked, but hysteria had me now, and I simply howled with glorious, tension-relieving laughter.
"Of course not,"
I managed to get out between rib-shaking paroxysms.
"But this whole thing, it's just so ridiculous."
"I'm glad you think so," she said frostily. "But if you think I'm just going to forget..." A brief hiccup interrupted her flow of invective.
"Forget this... Oh, Emperor, damn it all!"
And it infected her too. The throaty chuckle I'd found so appealing before erupted from her chest like magma. After that, there was no stopping either of us, and we simply held each other up until we could finally force the air to remain inside our aching ribs.
I would just like to point out here that this is a perfectly normal reaction to severe stress, which can in no way be interpreted as irresponsible behaviour under the circumstances.
Afterwards, we both felt more like ourselves again, and were able to press on with renewed vigour. We'd resumed moving stealthily, though, as the mere fact that more cultists and stealers had failed to boil out of the walls at us probably meant we were alone down here. But we'd made enough noise between us to attract any search parties in the vicinity. Having nothing else to aim for, we kept moving towards the mysterious glow in the distance, and the closer we got, the brighter it became.
"That's definitely artificial," Amberley said, the yellowish tinge of electro-illumination unmistakable from this distance.
By the backwash of light it gave, I was able to make out more of our immediate surroundings, and I was surprised to note that the stonework surrounding us was now carefully dressed, the vaulted roof being supported by well-crafted columns. "I think we're in a cellar of some kind," I hazarded in an undertone. Amberley nodded. "I think you're right." She had the Auspex out again and was studying the display. "And there are people down here. Not many, according to this, but..." She didn't have to finish the sentence. Hybrid cultists might not register on it, and any pure strains in the vicinity certainly wouldn't. Advancing would be a terrible risk, but turning back, trying to find another route to the surface through a tunnel complex swarming with stealers and their dupes, would be almost as bad. And there was the time factor, too. The longer we took to report back, the longer the conspirators would have to provoke their war, assuming it hadn't broken out already. "Only one way to find out," I agreed, and we started cautiously forward again. The light was coming from a huge chamber, a high-vaulted ceiling supported by columns similar to the ones I'd noticed in the corridor, but far higher and thicker. Like the chamber we'd seen before, where the cultists had attacked us, there was a wide gallery running around the edge of the room, with a number of smaller tunnel mouths opening onto it. But to my relief, I couldn't see anyone or anything up there. This time, however, there was no humming machinery filling the space. It was light and airy, with braziers burning incense on marble plinths, and littered with antique statuary. Dusty boxes were everywhere, and I surmised we'd stumbled across some long-forgotten depository which the cultists had appropriated for their own purposes. We slunk into it like thieves, and took shelter behind one of the pillars holding the roof up. It was as thick as a cathedral column, and almost as wide as I am tall, and concealed the pair of us with ease.
"Stairs," Amberley nudged me and pointed.
Off to one side, a wide stone staircase rose to the gallery, from where another flight rose, cut into the stonework, rising out of sight.
"Great," I whispered back.
But getting to them would be another problem entirely. I could see figures moving around in the distance, some of them armed. There was the usual mixture of civilian clothing and PDF uniforms I'd grown used to seeing among the cultists, and something else, a bright flash of crimson and gold. I nudged Amberley and pointed.
"Palace guard,"
she nodded in response. That was a real surprise. From what Denali had said, I'd assumed they were all dead by now, but the cultists, as I'd seen on Kefia, would always try to look after their own. I began to suspect that their defence of the governor hadn't been quite as inept as they'd wanted us to think, forcing the situation to escalate by bringing the PDF onto the streets where their brood brothers could begin to work their insidious mischief. Instead of the antique long arm he'd been issued with, he was carrying a modern lasgun, looted, I assumed, from the PDF armory.
"We'll have to get past them," she whispered.
I nodded. Not an appealing prospect, by any means, but one we would have to attempt. If we kept to the cover of the pillars and the other detritus, we might just make it, at least most of the way, before we were spotted. When that happened, we'd just have to make a run for the stairs as best we could. As we moved off, I glanced around again, more by reflex than anything, trying to fix a sense of the space in my mind. Disorientation can be a killer in a firefight. And then it struck me. "This is a shrine," I murmured. Amberley didn't seem in the least surprised, but then I supposed she'd realized that the moment we'd walked in here. There were tapestries on the walls, which, now I came to look at them, I found myself recoiling from in horror. Blasphemous things they were, holy images of the Emperor profaned and debased, the father of all depicted as a hunched hybrid with too many arms, or a monstrous pure-strain stealer which seemed to tower over its adoring acolytes. I resolved to send a squad down here with flamers the moment we reported back. It seemed almost intolerable to me that such things should be allowed to exist. Ready? Amberley asked at my shoulder, and I nodded, making the sign of the Aquila for luck. My pistol was already in my hand, as I've said, and I drew my chainsword quietly with the other, thumb poised over the activator. Amberley drew her bolt pistol, checked that the first round was chambered, and nodded grimly.
Right, go!
We scuttled as far as the next pillar and went to ground again, my heart pounding in my ears. I was acutely aware of the background noise now, the sound I'd noticed in the corridor, the hum of activity as the cultists moved to and fro, but in eerie silence, as they had done in the chamber full of machinery. Praise the Emperor, none of them had spotted us. We moved again, making it to the shelter of the next column, and then on to the one after that. I was just beginning to hope that we would make it all the way to the stairs and whatever lay beyond, when the crack of a lasbolt against the stonework close to my head told me we'd been spotted. I turned, in time to see the palace guard levelling his lasgun for another shot, and brought up my pistol, but Amberley was faster, and her bolt pistol spat first. His chest exploded in a rain of red entrails and shredded gold armour, and before you know it, we were in the middle of a serious firefight. Two more armed cultists appeared, attempting to catch us in a crossfire, and we took one each, another chest shot for Amberley and a headshot for me, blowing the fellow's brains out through the back of his skull. Show off, Amberley grinned at me, and I didn't have the heart to tell her it had been a fluke. I'd aimed for the chest as well, and he ducked at just the right moment. More shots were being aimed at us from behind the pillars, but they were as well protected as we were, and our return fire had little effect beyond persuading them to keep their heads down. Looks like a standoff. What'll they do now? Rush us, I said, not relishing the prospect. Sure enough, a moment later we could discern a scuttling in the shadows, and my heart fell. Merciful Emperor, it's pure strains. A swarm of them, about a dozen strong, was hurrying towards us across the stone floor of the vault. A couple went down to our bolts and las shots, more by luck than judgment, I suspect, and in another moment I knew they'd be on us. I gripped my chainsword, determined to fend them off for as long as I could, clinging to the last desperate hope that I could somehow cut my way through to the stairwell, which right then looked about half the segmentum away. Suddenly an explosion rocked our ranks, then a couple more. Dazed and uncomprehending, I glanced upwards, expecting I knew not what. Perhaps the Emperor himself, since only divine intervention looked like saving us now. What I saw was almost as unexpected. The familiar shambling form of Jürgen, even grubbier than usual, lobbing frag grenades over the balustrade of the gallery. A small explosion of joy and relief shook my chest, and I grabbed Amberley's arm. Look! She glanced up and nodded, as though she'd half expected something of the sort, and stood. Time to run, she said, cool as you please. She headed for the stairs, and I followed, waving an acknowledgement to Jürgen. He waved back, grinning, and chucked another grenade into the milling mass of Steelers for luck. Most of them were down by now, leaking foul-smelling ichor, but one was up and running, inhumanly fast, heading straight for Amberley. Amberley! I shouted, and she half-turned towards it, but I could see the warning had come too late. Her bolt pistol would never come up to aim in time, and I was too far away to intervene. The claws I'd seen tear open Terminator armor, as though it were a crusty meat pie, were already slicing at her cape when its head exploded, showering her with an unpleasant organic residue and leaving the body to topple to the floor. I looked up at the gallery again and saw Sorrel already seeking a fresh target for his longlass. Emperor be praised, I breathed, my head still reeling with incomprehension, but grateful for this apparent miracle. I should have known better, of course. That moment of distraction almost cost me my life, and surely would have done if Jürgen hadn't shouted a warning. Commissar, behind you! I turned, expecting another foe to be charging in, and swung the chainsword in a reflexive defensive pattern. That surely saved my life, for instead of a cultist or a pure strain, which would have been bad enough, I came face to face with a creature from the worst of nightmares. Or to be more accurate, face to belly, as it was at least twice the height of a man. It was a twisted, grotesque, vast, bloated parody of a gene-stealer, and the whining blade bit deep into the arm, which would surely have ripped my head off if it hadn't been for Jürgen's shouted warning. It howled then, in anger and pain, and I was fighting desperately for my life. "It's the Patriarch!" Amberley yelled, as though I didn't know. From the corner of my eye, I could see her levelling the bolt pistol, waiting for an opening, but I was blocking her shot. I tried to twist out of the way, leaving room for her to aim, but the flailing multiple limbs of my bloated antagonist had boxed me in, and it was all I could do to keep parrying frantically with the chainsword as it swung one talon-tipped arm after another at me. This, then, was the source of the cancer which had infected Gravellax, the centre of the brood mind which the cultists shared, the instrument of the will of the tyrannid overmind which had sought to devour the sector unopposed by playing us off against the Tau. "Die, damn you!" I tried to bring my pistol to bear, but couldn't spare the concentration from the more urgent requirement to stay alive for the next few seconds, my entire attention on ducking, blocking, searching for an opening. Amberley's bolt pistol barked at last, and for an instant I thought I was saved, but the Patriarch fought on unharmed, and I realized she was keeping the cultists off my back. They were swarming out of the shadows now, desperate to help their sire and closing fast. The only mercy was that the ones with guns couldn't use them for fear of hitting the monster I battled. Sorrel had no such inhibitions, however. A chunk of chitin on the creature's head suddenly burst into bloody fragments, and it roared again, but barely staggered, its natural armor proof against a conventional lasbolt. It was momentarily distracted, though, and I was able to get a good cut across its belly at last. It staggered, thick, foul-smelling ichor beginning to leak from the wound, then came at me again with renewed fury. Seeing that the creature was invulnerable, Sorrel switched his aim and began taking down the cultists who were trying to get to me, while Amberley continued to do the same. "Hold on, Commissar!" Jürgen was running down the stairs, his melter readied, and I prayed to the Emperor that he wasn't going to try a shot from there, as I'd never survive it. But he had more sense than that, at least. "Sorrel!" Amberley called. "Clear a path for Jürgen!" The two of them began to concentrate their fire on the cultists between my aid and the desperate battle I still fought. I sprang back a fraction too late and felt talons scrape my ribs, ripping through the armor beneath my coat and burning like fire. I swore and struck back at the thing, taking the hand which had wounded me off at the wrist. Ichor pumped from it like a fire hose, spraying me and everything else in the vicinity, and if anything, it redoubled its efforts. I turned my head reflexively, trying to keep my eyes clear, and thus got a clear view of Jürgen as he raced across the floor towards me. For a heart-stopping instant, I thought a couple of pure strains were about to eviscerate him, but for some reason they hesitated for a fraction of a second, as they were about to close, and Sorrel and Amberley dropped them both with well-aimed shots in the nick of time. I turned back to the Patriarch, encouraged by my success in wounding it, and swung the chainsword again. It never even flinched, batting the humming blade aside, and I ducked a wild swing of its lower left arm. "What does it take to kill you, you bastard?" I snarled, carried away by my own anger and disgust. "How about this?" Jürgen asked, appearing at my elbow. As he approached the creature, it staggered back like the pure strains had done, momentarily disorientated, and he jammed the barrel of the melter into the wound I'd cut into its belly. As he pulled the trigger, its entire midsection flashed into steam and foul-smelling offal. It staggered back, its eyes glazing, and swung its head in confusion. Then slowly, it toppled over, vibrating the stone floor with the violent impact of its fall.
"Thank you, Jürgen," I said. "Much obliged."
"Don't mention it, sir," he said, turning the weapon to seek another target, but the cultists were scattering back into the shadows. For the first time, some of them gave voice, a keening wail that sent shivers down my spine. We sent a few shots after them, but I, for one, had had my fill of combat for the time being, and was more than happy to leave them for the follow-up teams. Without the Patriarch to focus and direct them, they would be easy enough to pick off, but they would have to be eradicated eventually. Otherwise, one of the surviving pure strains would grow to take its place, and the whole vile cancer would start to take root again.
"I thought you were dead," I said. Jürgen nodded.
"So did I, to be honest," he said. "They were almost on us when the wall collapsed. Then I thought it might be just as thin on the other side, so I took a shot at it on the off chance."
"I take it you were right," I said. He nodded again.
"Lucky that," he said.
"What about the others?"
Amberley asked, as we began to climb the stairs. Jürgen looked somber. "Sorrel made it through with me. We didn't see what happened to anyone else. But then he didn't have to.
They would have been overwhelmed in seconds. "Lucky you found us when you did," I said. "Not really." Sorrel had come to join us as we reached the level of the gallery. "We found your tracks in the dust and just followed along."
"How did you know it was us?" Amberley asked.
The marksman shrugged. "One pair of Imperial guard boots, one pair of ladies' shoes. Didn't need an inquisitor to work that one out."
"I suppose not."
She looked at him with something like respect.
"Once we heard shooting, we just moved to flank the position,"
Jürgen added.
"Standard operating procedure."
"I see." She nodded and pointed to the solid wooden door we'd reached at the top of the staircase.
"Jürgen, if you'd be so kind."
"My pleasure, miss."
He grinned, like a scholar student picked out to answer a question he knows the answer to, and vaporized it with a single blast from the melter, along with a generous section of the wall.
"Emperor's teeth," I breathed, as we entered the passageway beyond. It was panelled in burnished wood, a thick carpet on the floor, and delicate porcelain stood on the occasional tables of unmistakable antiquity. Bright afternoon sun stabbed our eyes through mullioned windows, and a dreadful suspicion began to form in my mind.
"I think I know where we are," I said.
Amberley nodded, her jaw set.
"Me too," she said grimly.
The silence was shattered by the bark of a bolt pistol, and Sorrel fell, chunks of his brain spattering an expensive-looking tapestry and staining it beyond repair.
"Commissar Kane and the charming Miss Vale."
Governor Grice was standing at the end of the corridor, gun held firmly in his hand, the air of vapid imbecility now totally dispelled.
"You really are most annoyingly persistent."
Editorial note. My apologies for this, once again. If it's any consolation, it really is the last time. Extracted from Like a Phoenix from the Flames, The Founding of the 597th, by General Jennet Sula, retired, 097.M42.
The renegades resisted doggedly, with a determination I could scarcely credit, and despite the faith I had in the women and men under my command, I must confess I began to doubt that our eventual inevitable victory could be won, other than at a terrible cost in the blood of these noble warriors. The traitors had prepared their positions well, and we could make little progress other than by fire and movement, scurrying from one piece of cover to the next. I gathered from the transmissions I could overhear that I was far from the only officer who found these delays unconscionable. Colonel Castine had already requested support from one of the armoured regiments among the expeditionary force, and some vigorous debate ensued as to whether the Tau would regard this as a provocation. Why anyone would care about the aliens' feelings was beyond me, I must confess, but much of what had transpired since our landing had left me in a state of some confusion, and I comforted myself with the knowledge that my understanding was not a requirement in any case. Duty and obedience was enough, as it should be for anyone privileged to wear the uniform of the Emperor. In the event the Lord General had acceded to her request, and the knowledge that a troop of layman Russes from the 8th Armoured was on their way had bolstered the spirits of our heroic forces to no little degree. In the meantime we were still pinned here, and the certainty that our reinforcements, however formidable, were still half an hour away was, I must confess, taking a tithe of the exhilaration we might otherwise have felt. I had no doubt that we could hold on until relieved, but even with the spirit of the Emperor burning within us, it could prove to be a close-run thing, if fate had any more surprises to throw at us. It was while I was reflecting thus that fate did indeed surprise me, and in a fashion I could never have anticipated. My first presentiment was a vox message sent from Sergeant Lustig, the doughty leader of Second Squad, who broke into my command frequency with some degree of urgency. "We have movement on our flank," he informed me. "Tau units closing fast, requesting instructions." To his great credit, it must be said that, despite the trepidation he no doubt felt, his report was never anything less than wholly professional. A few more exchanges, equally crisp, flew between us, during which time we established the presence of a handful of battlesuits, and at least one of the grav tanks our intelligence analysts had tagged Hammerheads. "Hold position," I ordered, despite the doubts which rose unbidden to my mind. Our rules of engagement had been clear, and despite the treachery we could no doubt expect from the inhuman, they had done nothing overt so far to break our incomprehensible truce. Lustig acknowledged, and we both waited tensely to see if the gamble we were taking with our soldiers' lives would be won or lost. I must confess that for a brief moment, as the sinister hull rose over the crest of the hillock of rubble my command squad had concealed itself behind, I had cause to curse myself for an overcautious fool. For as they came into sight, the cannon mounted atop it spoke, a thunderclap of sound which rolled over us like a physical wave, and I apprehended treachery afoot at last. But the ensuing explosion erupted in the centre of the insurrectionist fortifications, silencing their guns in a single display of sorcerous fury that left us all momentarily breathless. The tank moved on, humming quietly, with the energies keeping it aloft, and the battlesuits bounded after it, spraying the enemy positions with a prodigious amount of firepower. Rapid-fire plasma rounds burst and scorched among them, and salvos of missiles from the bulbous pods over the leaders' shoulders poured into them in rippling waves, bursting in gouts of flame and shrapnel, shredding and pulping the bodies of those who defied retribution. Bewildered as I was at this sudden turn of events, for I could conceive of no reason for the Xenos to turn against their erstwhile allies, I still had no doubt of my duty. "Follow up," I ordered. "After the Tau!" Bounding to my feet, I led the troopers under my command forward, towards the hole they'd punched for us through the enemy defences. "For justice! For vengeance! For the Emperor!"
Chapter 16. Life's so much easier when you've got someone to blame. Gilbrand Quayle, Collected Essays. "Traitor!" Jürgen raised the melter and took a determined pace forward, placing himself between Amberley and myself and the turncoat governor. Grice winced visibly as my aide moved closer to him, although his ever-present bouquet was no stronger than usual so far as I could tell, then squeezed the trigger again. The bolt exploded against the oversized helmet protecting Jürgen's head, flinging him backwards in a shower of shattered carapace. But thanks to the Emperor, or sheer good fortune, it hadn't penetrated this time. The sturdy armour protecting him from Sorrel's grisly fate. He staggered back into us, and we both moved instinctively to catch him, dropping our weapons as we did so. My pistol and Amberley's miniature bolter thudded into the spongy carpet, and my chainsword, still activated, spun into a corner where it began chewing energetically through the skirting board. "He's still alive," I told Amberley, feeling for the pulse at Jürgen's neck, and taking his weight fully into my arms. After all, I thought, if Grice fired again, I should be all right behind that amount of protection.
"Not for long if you don't keep him away from me," Grice threatened.
"You're one of them," Amberley stated flatly, as though this merely confirmed her suspicions. She took another step towards him, and Grice shifted his aim to cover her. I watched with some trepidation, for although she was still protected by the miraculous displacer field, she had told herself that it was not to be wholly relied upon. And even if it worked its magic again, her sudden absence would leave me wide open to a follow-up shot. I sagged a little, as though Jürgen's weight was greater than it was, and tried to work my hands towards the hell gun still slung across his shoulder. The governor grimaced, his mouth working in a manner not entirely human now I came to study it closely, and I berated myself for not having seen the truth sooner. The excessive bulk beneath his robes had not, as I had assumed on our first meeting, resulted from overindulgence and the commonplace inbreeding of most noble families, but from a far more sinister source.
"Something of an exaggeration, but widely believed nevertheless."
"The brood will survive," he said. "A new patriarch will arise."
"But not in your lifetime," I said, swiveling the hell gun under Jürgen's pungently damp armpit and squeezing the trigger.
The supercharged las blast screamed through the air between us, blasting a smoking crater through the left side of the governor's chest, and for a moment I felt the exultation of victory. It was short-lived, however, because to my horrified astonishment he didn't drop, just twisted aside with inhuman speed and switched the aim of the bolt pistol back to me. Thick plates of chitin were visible beneath the ruin of his robes now, and a third deformed arm emerged from the rent in the garment. Through my nausea, a sudden shaft of understanding lit up my synapses. "You were the assassin!" I gasped. A vivid mental picture of the events of that fateful night reeled through my brain. With a weapon concealed in that hidden extra hand, he could have shot the Tau ambassador before anyone had even the faintest suspicion of his murderous intent, and whatever disarray withdrawing it might have left in his clothing would be put down to the turmoil of the moment. Certainly all I'd seen was two empty hands and a hysterical El Hassai, who, I must reluctantly concede, had been right all along. "What was your first clue?" Amberley snapped, diving for her discarded weapon. I tried to take aim with the Hellgun again, but the strap was tangled in Jürgen's armor, and the dead weight of my unconscious aide was hindering me. As Grice's bolt pistol came up, I already knew I wasn't going to make it. Then for a blessed second he hesitated, still moving with preternatural speed, and pointed the gun back at Amberley. I suppose he realized that she would get to her bolt pistol and drop him if he didn't take her down first. I tried to shout a warning, but the first syllable of her name had barely made it through my horror-constricted throat before he fired. The bolt detonated against the floor, twisting the gun her fingertips had almost reached into scrap and sending splinters of wood flying into the air, but once again she was suddenly somewhere else. Some highly unladylike language and the crash of falling china a few meters further up the corridor told me that she'd collided with one of the little tables and its display of porcelain.
The displacer field, as those of you who've used one can no doubt attest, will readily teleport you out of immediate danger. Unfortunately, you rematerialize, moving at the same speed and in the same direction as when the field activates, and, as Kane points out, I was diving for a gun on the floor at the time. It was a stupid place to put a table in any case.
Grice looked astonished just long enough for me to tug the recalcitrant Hellgun around far enough to take another shot at him, which made a terrible mess of that tasteful wood panelling, but unfortunately did nothing worse to the tainted governor. He turned, following the sound of Amberley's landing, just in time to see her roll to her feet with the dexterousness of an accomplished martial artist. "Consider yourself relieved of your position," she said, pointing an accusing finger at him, like a scholar tutor admonishing an unsatisfactory student. He actually started to laugh, bringing the weapon round to bear on her again, when a bright flash erupted from the ornate ring I'd noticed at our first meeting. Grice staggered, falling back, and two hands went to his throat. The third continued to clutch his bolt pistol, which discharged again randomly as he sank to his knees. His face worked, as though gasping for air, and darkened with clotting blood. Pale yellow foam frothed over his engorging lips. "Digital Needler," Amberley explained, stepping delicately over the now spasming corpse. "The toxin's excruciatingly painful, I'm told." "Good," I said, aiming a bad-tempered kick at the erstwhile governor and hoping he was still conscious enough to feel it before he expired. "How's Jürgen?" She took the weight of his other shoulder and helped me to get him laid out on the floor. I began to remove the remains of his helmet carefully. "Not good," I said, a surprising amount of concern entering my voice. There was a lot of blood, but most of it seemed to be from superficial wounds caused by the shattered armor. Rather more worrying was the clear fluid mixed in with it. "I think his skull's fractured." "I think you're right." She began administering first aid with a speed and competence I found astonishing. "Better call for a Medicare unit." Cursing myself for my own stupidity, I activated my combead, realizing belatedly that I'd be able to get a message through to Castine now we'd returned to the surface. To my astonishment, however, the command channels were choked with traffic, and I turned back to Amberley with the bitter taste of failure burning in the back of my throat. "We're too late," I said. "It sounds as though the war's already started."
"Then we'll just have to stop it," she said matter-of-factly, her attention still on Jürgen.
At the time, still not realizing his significance, I was simply grateful for her concern for his welfare, even as I found the time to marvel at her indefatigable spirit.
If ever a woman seemed capable of stopping an all-out war single-handedly, it was her. I was just on the verge of replying when the wall blew in, throwing me to the floor yet again and showering what was left of the elegant decor with rubble. "What the frack?" I began, scrabbling for my fallen las pistol. I'd just managed to grab it when human figures in flak armor burst through the new gap, las guns leveled. Behind them, I noted absently, someone was making a hell of a mess of the garden. I just managed to prevent myself from squeezing the trigger in the nick of time as I recognized the armor as Imperial Guard issue. "Stand up slowly," a familiar voice barked, then took on a tinge of astonishment. "Commissar, is that you?" "Right now, I'm not entirely sure," I said. Castine looked at me for a long, searching moment before taking in the disheveled state of the Inquisitor. Then her gaze moved on and down to the prostrate figures of Jürgen and the Governor. I indicated my aid. "He needs a medic," I said. Then for some reason my legs gave way beneath me. "There's no doubt at all, then." Castine had listened to our story in silence, or at least to as much of it as Amberley felt like telling her, and I'd spent the last half hour or so alternately nodding, saying yes and really, and similar helpful remarks, and scrounging the largest mug of tanner leaf tea I could find. It was not the most obvious thing to find on a battlefield, you might think, but these were Valhallans after all, and it didn't take me long to discover a fire team brewing up once the immediate danger was past. Brocklaw was running around like the good second-in-command he was, detailing troopers to secure the perimeter and clear out the tunnels beneath what was left of the palace, and once I'd seen Jürgen safely on his way back to the aid station, I relished the chance to simply enjoy the feeling of sun on my face and the astonished realization that, against all the odds, I'd survived again. "None," Amberley said. "The body's all the proof we need. Grice was a Steeler hybrid and killed the ambassador to try to provoke a war. All the death and destruction in the city was just part of the same agenda." "Merciful Emperor," Castine breathed, appalled at the thought. "His own people, sacrificed in their thousands. The bastard." "His own people were the gene stealers," I said. "The rest of us, humans, Tau, even the Kroot, were never anything more to him than fodder for the hive fleets." "Exactly." Amberley looked sober for a moment, before the familiar carefree smile was suddenly back on her face. But it was there with an effort, I found myself thinking. And if we hadn't kept our heads, things might have turned out very differently. "They still might," I said, indicating the hulking figures of the Tau dreadnoughts around the perimeter, and the curiously rounded vehicles hovering over the surface of the grass. Tau troopers were beginning to deploy from some of them, eyeing our own soldiers suspiciously. But so far, at least, the two forces were keeping well apart. "Can we trust them now we don't have an enemy in common?" "For the time being, at least," Amberley said. She might have said more, but we were interrupted by a sudden shout from the direction of the ruins. "They found some survivors!" Castine hurried off, to where a small knot of figures were emerging from the wreckage of the palace. Amberley and I exchanged glances, an unspoken presentiment sparking between us, and trotted after her as best we could. Now we were safe. The exhaustion of our exertions had crashed in on us like a landslide, and I felt my calf muscles cramping as I tried to keep up. Even before we reached them, I caught a glimpse of red hair, so it was little surprise to me when the search team, one of the squads from Sula's platoon, I seem to recall, but I couldn't tell you which one, parted to reveal Valade and Hollenby, each supported by a trooper with an arm around the shoulders, holding hands like a pair of courting Tinas. It's no exaggeration to say they both looked like hell. But that's precisely what you'd expect, I suppose, their uniforms ragged and bandages leaking blood where the squad medic had applied field dressings to the worst of their wounds. Hollenby stared at me in numb confusion, but that was nothing new. "Where did you find them?" I asked the sergeant in charge, and he saluted me smartly.
"Down in the tunnel, sir. Lieutenant Sula told us to spread out and secure the perimeter below ground, and they were about half a clom in. They must have been in a hell of a fight, sir."
"Valade?" I asked gently. She turned her head towards me, her eyes unfocused. "What happened?"
"Sir?"
Her brow furrowed.
"We were fighting. Thomas and me."
"They were everywhere,"
Hollenby cut in, his voice distant.
"Then the roof came in, and we lost the others, so we fought our way out.
I see, I said, nodding slowly, and glanced across at Amberley. The same doubt was clouding her eyes, I could see. I turned back to the bedraggled troopers, then brought up my las pistol and shot them both through the head before either of them had a chance to react.
What the hell?
Castine shouted, her hand moving instinctively towards the bolt pistol on her hip until common sense reasserted itself and aborted the gesture. She glared at me, her jaw tight, and the troopers around us froze in shock, anger and confusion in their eyes. I had a sudden flash of déjà vu, an unbidden memory of the mess room aboard the Righteous Wrath. For a moment I was horribly unsure of myself, afraid I'd made a terrible mistake. Then I glanced again at Amberley for reassurance. She nodded, a barely noticeable acknowledgement, and I felt a little better. At least if I was wrong, an Inquisitor was too. Which wouldn't help much with rebuilding morale in the regiment, but at least I wouldn't be the only one left feeling embarrassed. I've seen this before, I said, addressing Castine directly, but keeping my voice loud enough and clear enough to be heard by everyone. On Kefia! I took the combat knife from the sergeant's harness and knelt beside Hollenby's body, ripping one of the dressings away to reveal a small, deep wound slanting up under the ribcage. I sliced it open, ignoring the horrified gasps from those around me, and felt around with blood-slick fingers. After a moment I found what I'd expected to be there, and yanked out a small, fibrous bundle of organic material.
What the hell's that?
Castine asked, over the sound of Sula being violently sick. A gene-stealer implant, Amberley explained. Once it takes root in a host, it gradually subverts their own genetic identity, turning any offspring into hybrids. A generation or two after that, you start to get pure strains showing up, along with hybrids almost indistinguishable from humans, and the taint continues to spread. She indicated an identical wound on Valade's torso. They were both infected when the Steelers overran them. The disorientation was the real giveaway, I added. The implant messes with the brain chemistry, so the host remains unaware of being infected. All they recall is a confused impression of fighting and assume they've escaped. It's often mistaken for combat fatigue, Amberley finished. Luckily, the Commissar could tell the difference, or your regiment would have been leaving hidden Steeler cults behind wherever you were deployed. I see, Castine nodded once, crisply, and turned to the sergeant. Burn the bodies. A wise precaution, Amberley said as the three of us turned away, and the sergeant went looking for a flamer. Colonel, Commissar! Brocklaw was waving from the ramp of a command chimera. One of our patrols found some tau down there, too. They're on their way back to the surface now. Amberley and I looked at one another and went to meet the survivors of the Shazla we'd met in the tunnels. Trepidation churned in my gut as the little group, reduced to three now, staggered into the sunlight. One had lost his helmet and squinted at the sudden brightness. I shivered, finding myself plunged into shadow as a devilfish troop carrier swept overhead and grounded to receive them. They looked disorientated, it was true, but they would have been as exhausted as we were, and I just couldn't be sure what the cause might be. These were Xenos, after all, and I just couldn't read them the way I could my own kind. So I stood there, paralyzed with indecision, while they staggered up the ramp and into the transport, aided by their fellows, and by then it was too late anyway. As I turned away, sick with apprehension, I found Amberley watching me with what I can only describe as a smile of satisfaction. For some reason, that failed to raise my spirits. If anything, it had quite the opposite effect.
Editorial note. Once again, we need to turn to other sources for a wider perspective on the aftermath of the affair than Kane's typically self-centered account gives us. From Purge the Guilty, an impartial account of the liberation of Gravilax, by Stententious Logar, 085.m42.
And thus it was that the world we so dearly love was saved from the depredations of the alien by the heroism of the warriors of his divine majesty and the martial fortitude of heroes whose names live on in the glory of their deeds. Even those of the caliber of the celebrated Commissar Kane, who, though his own contribution to this campaign was never more than peripheral, was no doubt proud to have been associated with so noble an endeavour. It is indeed a pity that, like most of the Imperial Guardsmen deployed in this most glorious of enterprises, he was able to do no more than remain on the sidelines. But he was at least in at the death, so to speak, having been present when the treacherous Governor Grice at last met deserved retribution at the hands of the Inquisition. Indeed, some even assert that he witnessed the celebrated duel to the death between the wretched traitor and the Inquisitor herself. Although, like most conscientious historians, I must reluctantly concede that this is, in all probability, nothing more than a charming myth. After a thorough examination of the evidence, it seems far more likely that an officer of his caliber would have been in the thick of the battle for control of the palace, especially once the perfidious Tau had moved in to try to protect the puppet their insidious rogue trader accomplices had installed on the throne there. Be that as it may, the Battle of the Palace was undoubtedly the true turning point in the history of our fair globe, when the grip of the Xenoist interloper was finally broken, and the relieved and grateful populace brought back at last under the protection of the Divine Emperor and his tireless servants. Broken and dispirited, the Tau departed, slinking away like the vagabond thieves they were, having failed to seize the fair world of Gravellax for their own. Within hours of their defeat at the hands of the Imperial Guard, they withdrew, not only from the city, but from the planet itself. One by one they fled aboard their starships, retreating back into the hinterland of space from whence they'd come, never to trouble us again. For you can be sure that we, the generations that followed, have been careful not to make the mistakes of our ancestors, and remain ever vigilant against the hour of their return. Even now our PDF units stand ready, at a moment's notice, to defend the sacred soil of His Majesty's most holy dominions to the uttermost drop of their blood, and it is our most fervent hope that one day the cream of these doughty warriors may be found worthy to take their place in the blessed ranks of the Imperial Guard itself. As to the rogue traders, we must be equally on our guard, for they remain among us, spreading their insidious web of treachery.
And so on, and so on. From which you might fairly deduce that the gene-stealer infestation remains a secret known only to a few. And since those few are either servants of the Inquisition or members of an Imperial Guard unit never likely to return to the wretched place, it's a secret which will remain secure. As to why this should be so important...
Epilogue. Stories are much tidier than real life. Stories have neat, happy endings, but all you ever really get is unfinished business. Yanni Vacons, Hollow Director. I'd seen little of Amberley in the week that followed our adventures in the Undercity, but we both had plenty to keep us occupied over those few days, so I hardly found her absence surprising. Jürgen was still recovering slowly, so I'd lost my principal buttress against most of the tedious minutiae of my job and found my workload drastically increased as a result. Add to that the fatigue and minor injuries I'd sustained, and I did little else apart from eat, sleep, and shuffle data files. Divas dropped round one evening with a bottle of Amasek, which provided a pleasant enough diversion, and filled me in on the latest gossip, which after the last time you can be sure I did my utmost to ignore, no point in taking any chances. "No one can understand it," he said at one point. "The tower just pulling out." I'd heard as much from other sources, most of them a good deal more reliable thanks to my connections in the Lord General's office, but I nodded nonetheless as I poured us both refills. "Well, that's Xenos for you," I said helpfully. "Who knows why they do anything?" Still didn't make much sense when Denali explained it to me, but he seemed to know what he was talking about, and Amberley confirmed it later, so it's the best I can do. You see, peculiar little devils that they are, they don't seem to value the objective of the fighting purely for itself the way we do. As best as I can understand it, they reckon that if we were that determined to pitch into a meat-grinder war to hang on to this worthless mudball, we might as well have it. They'd go off and do something more productive until we got bored or complacent or distracted, and come back for it later when we couldn't put up a decent fight for the place.
A little vague, but substantially correct. Tau tacticians tend to take the long view, withdrawing to regroup whenever they meet stronger resistance than they were expecting, or, as in this case, the situation proves to be more complex than anticipated.
And in the meantime, there was the High Fleet to worry about, assuming it was actually out there. Which, as we were subsequently to discover, it most certainly was. So, as you can appreciate, I was pleasantly surprised when a message arrived from Amberley inviting me to dinner at a discreet waterfront restaurant in a quarter of the city which seemed to have escaped the worst of the fighting. Even more so, given that I'd never expected to see her again, just how far off the mark that assumption was, you'll find ample evidence of elsewhere in this memoir, as I've already mentioned. "How's Jürgen?" she asked, over a mouth-watering, smoked veal crepe. Touched by her solitude, I filled her in on his recovery and asked how her associates were getting on in return. Reasonably well, as it turned out. Rakel was up and about and as bonkers as ever, and Aurelius had already returned to his ship. She nodded at the news. "I'm glad to hear it. He's a remarkable man." "He's certainly unusual," I agreed, savouring the local vintage she'd obtained from somewhere. Light and pecan. It complemented the food wonderfully. She smiled at that. "More so than you realise." Something about the way her tone changed alerted me, and I began to pay more attention to her words. This was more than mere small talk. "I don't think we'd have made it out of the tunnels without him." I thought back to my desperate duel with the Patriarch. If he hadn't scrounged that melter from somewhere, I agreed, but she cut me off before I could finish. "That isn't what I meant. Do you know what a blank is?" I must have looked baffled, because she went on to explain. "They're incredibly rare, about as rare among psychers as psychers are compared to the rest of us." "You think Jürgen's a psyker?" I asked, laughing in spite of myself and inclining my body slightly to the left to give the waiter room to remove my plate. The idea was so ridiculous I just couldn't help it, but Amberley shook her head. "No, quite the reverse. He's a blank, I'm sure of it." I echoed the gesture. "You've lost me," I admitted. "Blanks are like anti-psychers," she explained. "They can't be affected by psychers or warp entities. They block telepathic communication. You saw how the Patriarch reacted to him." "It seemed to get disorientated when he got close to it," I said, remembering. "And Grice was desperate to keep him away." Amberley nodded. "Exactly. His presence disrupted the brood telepathy." "That explains a lot," I said, recalling a number of incidents over the years which had seemed no more than mildly puzzling at the time, but which I now realized formed a pattern confirming my aid's resistance to psychic attack. "How long have you known?" "Since the first time I saw him," she admitted, "when Rakel had a seizure while he was trying to help her into the salamander." A terrible suspicion began to form. "You're going to recruit him, aren't you?" I said. "If he can face down demons and sorcerers, you're not going to leave him buried in an obscure Imperial Guard unit." She was smiling again, as though something amused her. "The Inquisition is an odd organization, Caiaphas," she said. "Not like the Guard, where everyone's united against a common foe, and you can rely on your comrades and your command structure." I wasn't sure what she was driving at then, but I've had rather more dealings with the Inquisition since than I'm comfortable with, and believe me, it makes sense. Just take my word for it, and hope you never have cause to find out. We're not very big on sharing our sources and resources, because we never really know who else in the Ordo is we can trust. As you'll appreciate, astonishment barely begins to cover what I felt listening to those words. So, no, I think for the time being I'd rather leave him where he is. It's safer that way. Safe? In a frontline guard unit? I thought she was joking at first, until I got a good look at her eyes. Blue and guileless, they shone with a sincerity that would have been impossible to fake. Believe me, I'm an expert at that. She nodded again. I'll be able to find you again if I need you. Either of you. And I was so caught up in the moment that the full implication of those words never struck me at the time. But if I take him on as one of my staff, he'll attract attention. The sort I'd rather avoid.
Like radicals with an agenda, or Ordo Malleus fanatics looking for demon fodder for their next crusade. Not my department, thank the Emperor.
I see. I didn't really. But the main point seemed to be that I wouldn't have to worry about losing my aid after all, at least in the short term. And it also hadn't escaped my notice that while he was around, I wouldn't have to worry about any passing psychers ferreting out secrets I'd rather leave buried. I started in on my toffee cream dessert with well-deserved enthusiasm.
Good.
Amberly grinned again, the mischievous expression I found so appealing back on her face. Besides, Rachel's hard enough to deal with at the best of times without passing out on me every 5 minutes.
I'm sure, I said.
The silence stretched awkwardly for a moment, so I made an attempt to change the subject.
You've heard about the Tau withdrawal, she nodded.
Elsarath still insists that the world is theirs by right, but they're agreeing to respect the status quo for the time being. I guess they blinked first.
She shrugged.
Besides, they're spooked by the idea of a high fleet moving in, even if they don't want to admit it. They've had a few skirmishes with splinter fleets in the last couple of centuries, and they're under no illusions about what a full-scale invasion would mean.
Neither was I, and I shuddered at the thought.
Hanging on to one small planet doesn't mean much in the face of that, especially if it would weaken their response to the greater threat.
Speaking of which,
I coughed delicately,
I'm still not entirely sure those Pathfinders, you know...
Who cares? Amberly sipped at her wine appreciatively. If they were, then at least it'll draw the High Fleets down on them instead of us a few generations down the line. And in the meantime, we can exploit the chaos in the Tau Empire for our own ends.
Good for us, then, I said. I raised my own glass. Confusion to our enemies.
And kudos to our friends.
Our glasses clinked together, and Amberly grinned at me again.
Here's to the beginning of a beautiful friendship.
Not to mention half a lifetime of running, shooting, and bowel-clenching terror, of course. But looking back, I have to say she made it well worth the effort.
And on that somewhat ego-boosting note, this extract from the Kane Archive comes to a natural conclusion.
That was Caiaphas Kane, For the Emperor, by Sandy Mitchell. Read by Stephen Perring, Penelope Rawlins, and Emma Gregory. This recording is copyrighted to Games Workshop 2017.
Audible hopes you've enjoyed this program.